Welcome to the Lawyerist Podcast, a series of discussions with entrepreneurs and innovators about building a successful law practice in today's challenging and constantly changing legal market. Lawyerist supports attorneys building client-centered and future-oriented small law firms through community, content, and coaching, both online and through the Lawyerist Lab. And now, from the team that brought you the Small Firm Roadmap and your podcast hosts.
Hi, I'm Stephanie Everett.
And I'm Jennifer Wiggum, and this is episode 494 of the Lawyerist Podcast, part of the Legal Talk Network. Today, Stephanie talks with Todd Rogers about his book, Writing for Busy Readers.
Today's podcast is brought to you by iLawyer Marketing, and you'll hear Zach's conversation with them in just a minute.
So Stephanie, in our last couple intros, we've just been addressing some common misconceptions about coaching because there seems to be more than I thought. And I think we still have a couple more to go over. So I wanted to see what you thought of how we can finish off this series on what you think is a misconception about coaching.
Yeah, I mean, super curious to hear what you've been hearing, but something that is that I've heard is that people perceive maybe, I don't know, the coach takes over or, you know, like our job is to tell you what to do and then you somehow lose autonomy over your business. And I only struggle with that because I'm like, no, that's not the case at all. It's your, you know, it's, but maybe that is a misconception people are having. So, I mean, I think, and I know our coaches agree, you know, we're there to partner. We're there to support you. We're there to help you. At the end of the day, it's your business and you make the decisions. I can't tell you. I mean, I can give you suggestions. I can help you brainstorm options. You know, we can think through what would it look like if I decide this or how might a different path look? I can share examples of what I've seen other businesses do, what's worked for them, maybe what's not, so that you can take all that information in. But at the end of the day, ask my husband. I've learned I can't make anyone do anything, right?
Like,
right? Especially spouses. So at the end of the day, I can help you and give you information you need. And I hope that in that work together, I can give you the confidence so that when you do make a decision, you feel really great about it. Because I think that's what, as a business owner, can be really tough is you're, you know, second guessing yourself or wondering which way I should go, what should I do? I want to give you the tools so when you do make that decision, you could be like, yes, this is the right decision.
Right. And it's actually something we encourage. We're not doing it for you. We're not just holding your hand and dragging you through the whole thing. We're meeting you halfway. You're doing the work. And we're doing the work alongside you. So there is no loss of autonomy. In fact, we actually expect you to show up and participate just as much as we are. So there is no chance that you will lose autonomy. We will make sure that you're also doing the work because it's your business and you need to leave confident that you're ready to run your business as well.
Yeah. I think that said, sometimes people wonder, like, am I just going to show up and have to talk about my feelings or right? Whatever's happening? And,
yeah.
And sometimes because that's where maybe you're feeling stuck is around your feelings, but we're not showing up to the meetings necessarily with that mindset. We're there to ask you about KPIs. And if you don't have KPIs yet, by the way, we have tools and resources. We're going to help you. Like we're going to do the work on the front end to help you kind of figure out what's your business priorities. What are those KPIs we can measure success? What is the action plan? And then we're going to be checking in on that. Now, as a result of that, what may come up is you're feeling stressed about something completely unrelated, we may or may not explore that because it's the next best thing for you. But we're not therapists.
No.
We are not going to like dive deep into your family history, your mom, you know, whatever, your mom, your dad, your whatever else is going on. In fact, some of, you know, a lot of people that we work with do go to therapy. I mean, we always encourage it because it's a completely different dynamic and it's a different work is happening with these different relationships, partnerships, help.
Yeah. And I think that what we try to find is obstacles that are getting in your way of getting your business to how you want. And sometimes that obstacle is a feeling you're anxious about, you're stressed about, but it's different in that we're not starting with that. We're just trying to figure out what the obstacle is. There is different types of coaching that you might consider new age or it's a little more spiritual. And that's just not what this is. It's business coaching and it's figuring out how to move your business forward, what the obstacles are and how we can get you what you want out of not just your business, but your life.
Yeah. Absolutely. You know, and I guess the other thing I would say is we follow our client's lead.
Yes.
So to be fair, because I hear you, and apparently someone showed up to a sales call recently and was worried that there'd be like, I don't know, crystals.
Yeah. Yep.
There might be some people in the program, lawyers, who might be into that kind of stuff.
Exactly.
I mean, I have no idea. I can't think of anyone off the top of my head. I mean, you know, but as our coach, we're not going to impose any of that on you. So, you know, I think you can feel comfortable in knowing that we follow your lead. So if you're thinking to yourself, but I like meditating and doing things that feel maybe a little on the more spiritual side, like we're also not going to block that. We're going to lean in to whatever skills and mechanisms work best for you. You know, if I had to describe our community, maybe people are curious, like what kind of lawyers are joining LAB? To me, one of the defining factors are really a couple of things. One is they're able to make decisions. And so they're able to move and make changes. Like we're all about implementing. And so we like to think of the firms we work with as little speedboats, not big barges. And so they have the ability to come in, absorb some new ideas and make changes. And that's really fun for us and for our clients, obviously. And then the second thing, if I had to kind of put a characteristic on it, is around this idea of law firm of the future means that we're embracing technology. We're embracing some ideas. Does it mean you have to know how to code to be in LAB? Absolutely not. That's not it either. But most of the people in the program are at least open to exploring and asking questions about, is there a way to do this differently, better? You know, maybe the way we've been running our law firms for the last 200 years, it's time for a revisit. Because if you think about the structure of law firms, not a lot has changed in the last 200 years until recently. And so if you're kind of frustrated because you go to bar meetings, you hang out with lawyers, and it just feels like everyone's like, that'll never work. You can't do it that way. That's crazy. I would say this is your community of people who are like, huh, maybe, or let's explore that more. Or could it work? And that's what we really are excited about. So even if you're not sure where you fall in that spectrum, you should at least be open to the idea that people are going to think about things and challenge each other on how we could practice law better and run law firms better.
Yeah. And if you're interested in LAB, which we hope that you are, we'll have something in the show notes where you can learn a little bit more about it and apply if you'd like. And now here's our conversation with our sponsored guest, and then we'll head into Stephanie's conversation with Todd.
Hey y'all, Zach here, and I've got Mike from iLawyer Marketing with me. Now, iLawyer Marketing is a full-service law firm marketing agency that handles everything from content creation and web design to pay-per-click and so-called over-the-top or streaming advertising. Mike, thanks for being with me today.
Thanks for having me, Zach. Good to be here.
So last time, or one of the previous times you were with us, we talked about the six elements of a successful law firm marketing campaign. And the time before this, we talked about why it's important to have a very good website for your law firm. But today I'd like to dig into visibility, website or internet visibility, Google visibility. Can you talk a little bit about that for us?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, that is by far the most important part of this process, is having that high visibility online. I mean, if you are a law firm owner, people need to be able to find you. And usually the way that people are going to find a law firm is through Google. So number one, having that high visibility on Google is an absolutely crucial part of the process.
So I know that people hear SEO and Google ranking and everything, and it feels a little magical to some people, I think. Can you talk to us a little bit about how people go about increasing their visibility or what they can do to make this a little bit better for themselves?
Definitely. I mean, I have a little bit, I'll say just a little tiny bit of experience here, because I've only been doing this for the past 20 years. So just a little bit of time there. No joke, probably every single day, nearly every single day of the last 20 years, I've been obsessed with Google's algorithm, and I've been studying it. And we have even created software that monitors Google algorithm shifts, because we're tracking nearly 30,000 keywords on an every single day basis of those Google rankings and how the Google algorithm updates on such a frequent basis. In fact, I think in the last year, they updated their algorithm almost 4,000 times. So you can imagine how that changes the volatility of the search results that we see. And that's why we see rankings that you may have one day, maybe they disappear the next day, or they go up, they go down. But there's a lot of factors that go into Google rankings. One of the most important factors is content, and content is becoming a more important factor when it comes to Google. Mm-hmm. You may have heard the saying, content is king. Well, that certainly holds true today when it comes to Google rankings.
Right, because what is Google trying to figure out when they're adjusting these algorithms? Although they may seem pretty random, I assume that that's not the goal of Google, is to play hide the ball here.
No, I mean, ultimately, the goal for Google is to serve the absolute best results for whoever the person is that is running a query on their search engine, right? They want to have the very best results, because what that means for them, more people using their engine, which means more people are clicking on the ads that appear in those search results. And so that's how Google makes the majority of their revenue, billions and billions of dollars, just from the ads that they serve. Mm-hmm. And so that is the ultimate goal. It's not to kind of trick people. It is to really to try to serve the best results as possible. So when it comes to law firm marketing, ideally you have visibility, not just with the organic results, but you also have some visibility with paid. In 2024, the smartest way to market your law firm is by having a multi-channel approach. By multi-channel, I mean Google Organics, Google Paid. If you can rank in the local pack of Google, that's important. But then on top of that, you also want visibility on Facebook and Instagram, YouTube, potentially LinkedIn or TikTok, depending on who your target audience is. But in a perfect world, if you're a law firm, you want to have that visibility in as many places as possible. Ideally, if people come to your website, you want to bring them back with retargeting ads. And that's why you sometimes see those ads that follow you around. Well, that's a smart way. If you're a law firm, that's a smart way to get people to remember that you exist and to bring them back to your site, because ultimately that is going to be the absolute best way to drive leads for your firm and ultimately help you generate more new cases.
Okay, this makes a lot more sense to me. We're not just talking about, you know, ranking specifically on search. We're talking about just broad visibility on the internet for your law firm. And that is something much more than just packing keywords into your SEO title area.
100%. Yeah. I mean, we've done a lot of studies over the years and really trying to get inside the mind of the consumer, how they go about searching to find a lawyer. And most people, you know, they will do a search online, or maybe they do a few searches online, but then they don't always instantly call that law firm, right? Their life gets in the way. They're, you know, going to pick up their kids, or they're going to work, or whatever it is, and they come back. Eventually, you want to remind them that you're still out there. And so if they visit your website and then, you know, they're off going to work or to handle groceries or whatever it is they're doing, you, when they go back and then they're on Facebook, for example, you want them to see ads of your firm to remind them that you still exist. And that having that multi-channel approach is going to be the way that you drive more leads and more business for your law firm. And if you're like most of the firms that come to us, what they care about is driving leads, signing up more new cases so they can increase revenues for their firm. So that is an important part of the process, is having that multi-channel approach.
Okay. Sounds like it's a lot more to think about than just handing this off to, you know, some marketing company and, you know, forgetting about it. People can get a 30-minute strategy session with you or somebody from your firm if they go to ilawyermarketing.com.
Yeah, I'll send a link to you so you have that in your show notes. But we do offer a 30-minute strategy session, and it's with one of our senior law firm marketing specialists. We have three senior specialists. They've all been doing law firm marketing for a minimum of 6 years. Our most senior one has been doing it for 15 years. As I said before, I've been doing it for 20 years. So, you know, I've trained all these consultants. And the way that we create these strategies for law firms that we believe is a little bit smarter than the rest. And I think just having that experience, been doing this for so long, kind of helps, gives us an idea of what exactly we need to do to make law firm marketing successful for any firm we work with.
Well, the price is certainly right there. And again, it's at ilawyermarketing.com. We will drop the link into the show notes. Mike, once again, thanks for being with me and talking about SEO and visibility on Google and throughout the internet.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having me again, Zach.
Hi, I'm Todd Rogers. I'm a professor of public policy at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government.
Hey, Todd, welcome to the show. We are excited to have you today because we're going to talk about something that we do every day and probably don't think about nearly as much, which is writing and how to write effectively.
Great. I love talking about writing.
Right. Okay. Not many people do.
Yeah. I mean, I find writing hard and reading hard. And I think that it's kind of one of the ways people talk about research is it's me search. So I have spent a lot of time thinking about how do we write effectively for busy people.
Yeah. And you actually have a book out on just that subject. So for, and we'll put obviously links in the show notes, but Writing for Busy Readers, Communicate More Effectively in the Real World. I say that I look confused because I'm like, actually the title has a whole bunch of other words scratched through. So that's even in the title, you're trying to convey like, wait, should I read the ones that aren't part of the title? It'll make sense when you see the visual.
Yeah, we thought so like it's a long sentence, like we write more and more in this busy world and everyone is skimming and we cross out all the words and eventually says writing for busy readers. I like it. It seems clever, but it also seems super cluttered. And so I don't know.
Well, so we were just chatting about lawyers and the legal industry. And, you know, a lot of people over the years have come to me and said, I love to argue. I want to be a lawyer. And I always say, well, lawyers are actually professional writers. Like we don't think of ourselves, you know, the image you get on TV is we go to court and we have to give these amazing oral arguments. But a lot of what we actually do day to day is write.
Lawyers and everyone else, really. I mean, whether it's text messages or emails or professional reports and evaluations and proposals, there's just writing. More words are being written now than ever, which also means readers are on the other side receiving just this flood of written words. And so that's the challenge we have to navigate.
Yeah, you start off the book and some of the stats you give are quite scary. Like, professionals admitted that they delete about half the emails they receive before they even, without reading them at all.
Yeah. I was surprised to see that, but also surprised to see people acknowledge that.
Yeah. So we know we're fighting for people's attention. So we're putting all this content out there. And the reality is people probably aren't reading it, or maybe they're skimming or scanning it as you discuss. But we need to do better. Like it's our job to convey information to people. So the onus is on us to actually write like more effectively.
Yeah. And Jessica Lasky-Fink is my co-author on this book. And we have this perspective where we say, what if it's always our responsibility if the reader doesn't actually read what we send them? Like, what if we just accept the reality as everyone is busy and everyone is skimming? And so if we write a long thing that is dense and hard to make sense of, and they don't read it, it's on us, not on them. And if we take that kind of ownership of it, then it shifts to like, oh, okay, not only do I need to effectively capture everything I need to say, but I also need to structure it and make hard decisions about how to make it easiest for them to read.
Yeah. And so how do we even approach the process when we're starting to think about this? I mean, obviously the book lays out these really nice principles to help us get going. And so maybe where do you tell people to start? What's the first step?
I really think that the way to start is starting with, if it's our responsibility as writers to make sure that the reader reads it, knowing that they are going to be skimming, then how do we do it? And I guess then we start in like, okay, well, let's write. One of the things that has been most surprising with all the organizations, we work with a lot of governments and lawyers across different organizations and other communicators, is you can't write effectively if you don't know exactly what your goals are. And it is surprising that we often write with lots of goals intermingled, crossing without a lot of clarity on, if I had to rank order, there's really only one important thing I need to convey. Everything else is bonus. And in that case, it becomes a lot easier to write effectively.
Yeah. I expect that most of us are just banging through the day trying to get as many tasks done as possible. So it's like, oh, I need to respond to this client. I need to update this person, or I need to send out an offer to opposing counsel. And you're just cranking out content without really stopping and thinking about what is actually the goal of this communication.
Right. That's exactly. And once it becomes clear what the goal is, then we start to apply, well, okay, so how do we use these principles to write to make it more effective. And I should, just at the start, here's the TLDR version of this work, the too long didn't read version, which, you know, I get the irony. The TLDR version is we should make it as easy as possible for our reader, because when we make it easier for them, they're more likely to help us achieve our goal, which is to have them read, understand, and respond. And it's also kinder to them. It just saves them time. If they are motivated and they commit the effort and cognitive attention, they're more likely to do it. And they save time and effort when they do it.
Totally makes sense. And I think it's easy just to forget. I think so. It's something that we would definitely need to keep top of mind, probably every day. I mean, I know. And so then once you understand your goals, you know, the very first thing you say is less is more. And it immediately took me back to law school. So the very first semester of law school, we have to take a writing class and we are given page limits, right? It's the hardest part about that class is like you can only write whatever it is you need to do in five pages or however many pages it was. And I just remember constantly like editing every word matters. And so we were trained. And now even with courts, you often have page limits. And that is always the hardest thing is like, how can I fit all this in such a confined space?
I hope that we don't treat page limits as the expectation. It is the cap, the max. It's not the target. The first
not for lawyers. They're like, okay, I got it in every like little thing matters.
Yeah, in advance of this, I was looking around. I remember reading, and I wasn't able to find the research, but I remember reading that Supreme Court amicus briefs were more likely to be cited if they were shorter. I couldn't find that, so I'm fake news because I can't cite it. But the idea is think about the lived experience of the judge or the clerks like having to definitely read more than they have time for. They have to. Some of your audience has probably been clerks or judges. But the first is less is more. And I recently came across, really recently, and I love it. I came across a memo written by Winston Churchill during the Battle of Britain. So we're summer of 1940, the Blitzkrieg bombing London. And he is in a bunker and he writes a memo called Brevity. And he says, we need to write more concisely because winning the war effort is going to require that we communicate better. And I like, you know, he's trying to win a war and he's saying we need to be more brief. Okay, but that's the motivating one. The idea is we've done lots of randomized control trials. I should say this is the approach that Jessica and I take on everything. So we run randomized experiments where we'll have message one and then another one. And so my favorite of these was I was working with one of the two US federal political parties, and they have 700,000 donors, and they were writing a fundraising email, and they called and asked what experiment we think they should do. And I was like, well, what if you delete every other paragraph arbitrarily? So it's incoherent. It was eight paragraphs. And I was like, just delete every other paragraph so it makes no sense anymore. We had people read both. And they agreed that the shorter one was incoherent. And it still raised almost 20% more money. We ran an experiment where we scraped the email addresses of 7,000 school board members. Many are elected, or they're all elected or appointed. And I sent them an email asking them to fill out a survey. And in one, I was like, you do important work. Thank you. You balance competing interests. Lots of lives are affected by what you do. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Please fill out my survey. In the other, I just said, I'm a professor, the same thing, except I deleted all the gratuitous thank yous, cut the words in half. People read it both. When we hire people to read both, they massively disproportionately think the longer, more gratuitously grateful version is going to be more effective. But we double response rates by cutting it in half. And we have lots of examples of this across every kind of modality. Basically, more words, more ideas decreases people's likelihood of reading, understanding, and responding.
Yeah. And yet as lawyers, I read in the book, you know, a lot of times when you ask people to edit, they want to add ideas, they want to add words. And I think like, that's what we think is, oh, if I just give one more reason or one more fact to support this thing, it's going to trump up my argument more and make it more effective.
Yeah, there's great. I'm so glad that you pulled that out of it. It's not my research, but I absolutely love it. It's by a woman named Gabrielle Adams and her team, where across basically every category, if you ask people to, quote, improve this, you have an itinerary for a trip, you have a short story, you have a Lego building, anything, you ask them to improve it, they add to it. They just don't think that the way to improve it is to remove from it. And so what she and her team established is that we have this, like, we tend to neglect thinking that improvement can come from removal, subtraction. And so what we're saying is, it turns out not only is subtraction underappreciated and underdone, but it actually, when it comes to writing, makes it more likely, it makes it more effective when you make it less. Less is more.
So fewer words, fewer ideas, fewer requests.
Yeah, the request one, we didn't talk about, which is, I'm sure this we all live in. Stephanie, you and I are emailing. I have three follow-up questions for you after this. One of them is really important. The other two are extra. If I add all three of them in my message, I will decrease the likelihood that you read that you respond at all, and that you respond to the important one. And so the more we ask of people, the less likely they are to do any one of the things. And so again, we have to really prioritize what is the most important, what's our goal, because, and know that there's a trade-off. It doesn't mean we can't ask for multiple things, but just the more we add, we have to know that there's a trade. The trade is they will be slower and less likely to do it, any of them.
Yeah. I mean, it makes sense. I know I do that all the time. Oh, that response is going to require thought. Or whatever, it's going to require extra work. I'll just get to it later. And then days, sometimes weeks go by. And then I start feeling guilty because I haven't responded, which then that's a whole nother issue. It just like feeds into my lack of response.
Oh, I love that one. So one of the ways that gets me motivated to respond to people is there. I haven't seen research on this. I actually should do this. I'm going to write this down. We'll talk about it afterwards. But the longer the delay between when you received it, when you responded, the more I presume the reader is going to think I put into it. And so I can't give a one sentence response 3 weeks later, but I can give a one sentence response the minute I receive it. And so I'm like particularly motivated to be quick only because I don't want to have to put more effort in. And I think I'm licensed to be quick if I do it quickly, but that's not one of the principles. The principle we were just talking about is less is more.
Yeah. Less is more. Next, you talk about making reading easier.
Yes, this is where we're going to talk about legalese. The idea is the way to make it easier for readers is to reduce the amount of effort required to make sense of what they're reading. So easier for readers in this case means common words, shorter sentences. And the coolest thing that I learned, Jessica would say something, she had other parts that she loved from writing the book. But for me was learning about eye tracking. Research where they like strap you in, you watch, and then they watch your eyes as you read sentences. And you go word, 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 period. And there's a thing called the period pause effect, which is you just sit on the period and sit there and just wait. Because what seems to be happening is you're sense making. The sentence is over. What was it about? And often you have to go backwards and reread the sentence. We do it automatically. You probably don't even notice. I didn't notice till I saw this research. But the longer the sentence and the more complicated the sentence, the longer the pause and the more likely they have to go backwards. That means more cognitive effort. It also means more likely to quit, which is what we're always fighting. We want them to engage in the first place and we want them to get the key info before they give up. And they're going to give up. And so the idea here is write in a way that makes it easy to read. Common words, short sentences, short words. That's the big gist of that principle.
You give this example in the book that I love, so I marked it because it was a sign, I think, in a Canadian park. And the sign, the first version is, persons shall remove all excrement from pets pursuant, then underneath, by law, number, blah, 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 you know, max penalty, $200. Thank you. And it's like, what? What, you know, you have to sit and say, wait, what, do I know what all those words mean? There's big words in there. It just doesn't make sense. And then that, I guess the team rewrote it to scoop your pet's poop.
Done. Right. And so I love that. And we were on the fence about whether it was inappropriate for a book or a podcast for lawyers. But the idea is that that is legalese, that like it seems clear to the writer. It is inaccessible to most readers. So the median U.S. adult, 50th percentile, rank order all adults in their ability to read. The 50th percentile is ninth grade reading level. So that sentence, totally inaccessible to the majority of Americans or Canadians. Let's assume Canadians read at the same level as Americans do.
Sure.
Inaccessible to the majority of people. And then for those who it is accessible to, like, I know what those words mean. I'm going to just skip it because it's just painful.
Right. Yeah, I agree. And I think we as lawyers, we get ourselves sometimes, even though we all know we have to stop writing in legalese, like this has been beat in our heads. We still think it makes us sound smart or important, or that we have to use the legal words because, you know, it's in the statute. So why wouldn't I quote what the law says to explain to someone what the law is? And it's like, but that's not effective.
I love it. I pulled up in advance while we were chatting earlier. There's a paper that came out in one of the top journals in the world called The Proceedings of the National Academy of Science. And it was just, the title is written in pretty plain language. It is, even lawyers do not like legalese. And it's a study where they have lawyers read plain language or legalese language. And they find that lawyers understand it less well when it's written in legalese, and they dislike it. And so even I'm going to tell you on behalf of lay people don't like legalese. And it turns out that your colleagues don't either.
Exactly. I love the third principle. So I want to jump there because it's all about designing for easy navigation. And I think this is where, you know, it's kind of fun opportunities, but I think this is where we get into italics and spacing and visuals and things that actually really matter when we're writing, because nobody wants to read a wall of text. And we sometimes forget that.
Yeah. The idea is design for navigation. And it's, in a sense, it's thinking of writing as not just the words, but the way it's presented. And so we've done these experiments where when you add headings, you double the people's likelihood of getting past the second paragraph, right? Which is like, if it's just a wall of paragraphs, you know that you have to like read it and engage with it to understand it. Whereas when there's headings, people will do what you mentioned earlier, which is called scanning. They'll just jump around and see the headings before they deeply engage in any one section. And so adding structure makes it easier for people to navigate. You talked about formatting, which will, I guess, is one of the other principles, but is very similar.
Yeah.
Which is, people interpret bold, underline, and highlight as meaning the writer is telling the reader, this is the most important content. And that's incredibly powerful for us as writers, bold, underline, and highlight. But it also has these trade-offs that are kind of subtle, where we've done these experiments where you bold or underline or highlight some text, and then you have secret text that is not bolded, underlined, or highlighted, and it decreases people's likelihood of reading anything else, right? So like, you actually, they jump to the formatted text that you're saying, this is the most important thing. And then because they're busy, like the rest of us, they're like, good, I'm done. Now I can move on. And then they skip everything else. So there's these trade-offs. But the high level of it is, we want to think about the way we lay out and structure things as helping to make it easier for the reader. And some is formatting, some is bullets and headings. Some is even just like what information is next to each other. So if you're organizing a meeting, like we're trying to find a time that works for the six of us, the easier we make it for everybody by putting key information next to each other, like, for example, the dates and whether it's in person and the address all in the same spot, makes it easier for people to respond and do it than having to search through the whole chain.
Yeah. It all makes sense when we like break it down, but it's all driving to that point of, are you making it easy for people to capture the ideas? What am I trying to say? Like actually like embrace and understand the ideas. So that's why I think all these things, it makes sense to me. They all work together, and we have to be intentional about how we're using all these principles at the same time.
Yeah. I assume there are a bunch of veterans who are listeners, and I would ask, if we were all together, I would say, tell the rest of the group, what does bluff mean? And some people would jump up and say that this is the favorite thing they learned about writing while in the military, which is the U.S. Army started this policy that now everyone else has adopted called bottom line up front. Bluff. Mm-hmm. Bottom line up front. And it sets the norm. When I am writing as an enlisted person to a general, first line is the bottom line. And if I'm a general writing to an enlisted person, first line is the bottom line. And it makes it easier for writers to know where to put the bottom line. It also makes it easier for readers to know where to jump to. But the thing that I think is a hidden benefit of that is it especially helps lower status readers, lower status writers. Like an enlisted person writing to a general might spend a paragraph or two throat clearing about how I respect the work you did. We ran across each other in Kandahar and the mess, you wouldn't remember me, but I've really followed your work. And then there, whatever the bottom line is. And it makes it's especially hard for lower status writers when writing up the hierarchy to be direct. And so having a rule like this, which doesn't work everywhere and may not work. Well, I guess you guys have executive summaries and like you have different like spaces for these kind of things. But the idea is you want to make it easy for your reader to know where to pull the key information.
Yeah. It's interesting because I'm also thinking I have a virtual assistant who actually English is her second language. She lives outside Mexico City. And to her credit, she speaks like five languages. Like she's amazing, but she's working for us and she often writes emails on my behalf. And in a recent review, I was like, listen, everything you say is grammatically correct. Your English makes sense. It's just not the right way we write. Like she would start an email on my behalf, you know, dear Todd, it's so lovely to be corresponding with you today. I am Stephanie's personal assistant, and I'm going to reach out today to talk to you about scheduling this podcast. We'd like to, whatever it was. And I was like, it was interesting to have to give her feedback because I said to her, I said, you're not wrong. It's just not how we write. It's not how we talk to each other. And so you're losing readers because I don't need all that fluff. Like just, hey, how's it going? Whatever. Or, you know, maybe I don't even always say like, how's it going anymore? I'm just like, whatever, like, let's get in and get to the point.
It's especially hard for English as second, or for someone writing in a second language. These are true. The principles are true across all languages because the idea is everyone everywhere is busy and skimming. And so how that operationalizes into the context in which you're writing, whether it's a different language, a different culture, or a different purpose, it'll vary. So I almost always include a completely like a vacuous, I hope you're well, or I'm trying to get creative with it. I think today I did something like, I hope you're having a good day. That was my creative version. Okay. but I have something to convey that I'm human because yes. If it's just all business, I may offend some people who expect those courtesies, but also like it sets a norm. But with my co-author, like Jessica, like we can write directly because we don't have to, because we write enough to each other. But so there are different norms, even on the same purpose of message. It just depends. You have to be able to read the norm of the group you're writing with.
Absolutely. There's a couple more principles that are in the book, you know, tell readers why they should care, which I took as like write from the reader's perspective. This is a huge point we make a lot in our marketing, right? When we're teaching people how to write marketing material, we're like, stop writing about yourselves, write about your clients. So this kind of hit home for me in that way.
And the idea here, the principle is like, emphasize what the reader might care about.
Yeah.
Right. That's what we're, I want to make one like thing that's kind of subtle in this that we want to draw. We are not saying write about what the reader cares about because you have your purpose, right? Like, you have your goal in your writing and you don't have to shift what it is. You are entitled to your goal for your purpose. That said, there might be seven or eight things that you're noting, and of them, something your reader might care particularly about. And you may as well emphasize that. That's sort of the way that we have come to think about this, which is like, sure, you can add stuff if you think it'll like entice the reader, but really among the entire suite of topics you're going to cover, you may as well emphasize the one they're going to care about. That's the summary version of it. But I do think that emphasizing what the reader cares about is helping to get more of their attention. That's where the way we think about it is like Some of it is about like, they're going to skim. Let's make sure we get through to them. And some of it is about negotiating to try and earn more of their attention. And teasing them with something they value will probably allow you to capture a little bit more of it if they're engaging at all.
Yeah. I mean, obviously the book has all these principles laid out. We're not going to have time for the sixth one. And there's a whole bunch of tips and tricks at the end. I do want to make this kind of point that it really struck me in writing it. And I'm sorry, in reading the book, which is lawyers, like, we get trained in this. I just opened by telling you that my very first class in law school was a writing class that we took. It was a year long writing class. And so we spend a lot of time learning and thinking about our writing. But these principles apply to our team, you know, the paralegals, the legal assistants, everybody else, our salespeople. I mean, I was just having, before we recorded this, I was on with our sales leader for our team. And I was like, hey, I just read this book for the podcast. I was like, I'm actually interviewing the author after this. And this is something we need to train the sales team on. Because if they're not writing effective follow-up emails after a sales call, you know, we're missing people. Like, what's happening there? Like, I just don't want to take for granted that like writing is such an important part of everyone's job. And we need to remember, like, I think this would be great training for the rest of the team to also engage in, because sometimes we forget that they might not have the same level of training in this way as we do.
I'm glad you extended it. It's not, I mean, we have been talking about lawyerly writing, but most of our writing is not to courts. It is practical writing. But even when we are writing to courts, one of the frameworks that we use is like, look, writing has at least two purposes. One, it helps us clarify our own thinking. And the other is that it does the magic of getting an idea from my head into someone else's without being in person. And they are two totally different functions. And as such, how to do them well differs. And so clarifying your own thinking is stage one. Stage two is then writing it so that it's easy to transfer. The other thing I just sort of, as we, you think about lawyer, like the practical writing that you as a lawyer or your teams might do, there's argument and clarity. That's probably the core focus of what you're writing about, is like, I want to be clear and I want to be persuasive in whatever I'm saying or doing. I want to add another step to it, which is ease. In addition to being effective, like to being clear, in addition to being persuasive, like none of that's going to matter if they don't engage with it and read it enough to understand it. And so we need to add a round of writing, of editing to everything we write, where we ask ourselves, how do I make it easier for the reader? Because that'll help us be more effective.
So Todd, before we wrap up, you've been doing some cool work around AI, and it's such a hot topic right now. We should probably talk about it, because now everybody's running to, you know, Copilot and ChatGPT to write and seeing what it spits out. So first, I guess, let me just kind of kick us off. How are you approaching AI as a writing tool?
So I think I have two levels of response. The first is what we're talking about, making it easy for readers, whether a human is writing it or a human with an AI or just an AI, if we want humans to read it, this is how we should write to make it easy. It doesn't matter on the production side, whether it's AI or human. And there's a different discussion about all of that. So it's still relevant as long as we want humans to read it. The second is, we trained GPT-4, which at the time of recording now is the most sophisticated large language model from OpenAI. And we trained it on the principles that you and I just talked through. And then we tuned it for some emails where we had pre and post, like original and then edited, original and edited, so that it learned how to apply these principles. And it's so fun. You should check it out. I know that we were talking earlier about it. It's so fun because you can paste an email in, either one you received or one that you drafted, and then it structures it so it's easy to skim. It's not about summarizing it. It's about restructuring it so the sentences are shorter, there's formatting to reinforce the purpose, it's easy for a skimmer to pull out the key info. I'll give you in the show notes a link to it, but it's super fun. Like, even just like play around with it. It's a nice coach, a 24/7 coach.
Yeah, I love that. And I love the idea of using AI in that way, because sometimes I use it to generate ideas or just to kind of get started, because we all know starting with a blank page can be hard, intimidating, frustrating. But then, I mean, so far, like, it still needs work, whatever it's spitting out to me. But I love the idea that here's a different tool you can use in a different way to apply these principles. I think that makes a ton of sense.
Yeah, for practical email. That's the idea. Yeah.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, thank you for that. We're going to put that link in the show notes. So I encourage everyone to go and check it out and share it with your team. That could be an easy way to get your emails, at least get your emails on the right track. I feel like we could geek out on this all day. I love it. This has been so much fun because it kind of did take me back reading the book. I was like, all right, it's been a minute since I've really actually thought about honing my writing craft. And yet I do it every day. Like, this is such an important part of my job. And so I appreciate the book and this conversation as a reminder to everyone, like, don't take this for granted. It's serious stuff and we need to work on it and improve it.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. And because repetition is central to learning, I just want to drive home. The goal is we should add a round of editing to everything we write where we ask ourselves, how do I make it easier for the reader? That helps us be more effective. And it's also just kinder to the reader. Stephanie, thanks for having me on.
Thank you for being with me.
The Lawyerist Podcast is edited by Brittany Felix. Are you ready to implement the ideas we discuss here into your practice? Wondering what to do next? Here are your first two steps. First, if you haven't read the Small Firm Roadmap yet, grab the first chapter for free at lawyerist.com/book. Looking for help beyond the book? Let's chat about whether our coaching communities are right for you. Head to lawyerist.com/community/lab to schedule a 10-minute call with our team to learn more. The views expressed by the participants are their own and are not endorsed by Legal Talk Network. Nothing said in this podcast is legal advice for you.